All right, welcome to the Table Talk podcast. I'm here with Dr. Liam Latouche, and he is a naturopathic physician. And so we've had a couple other naturopaths on the podcast as well, and they just really are able to see things from a different perspective. They do a lot of similar training to our conventional providers, but also get this expanded sort of functional holistic view that we all talk about all the time. Thank you so much for joining us. And he is also going to be a speaker in our program that's upcoming on March 2nd. So this podcast may be out after that on the Table Talk platform, but we're going to share some of these tidbits prior to the program on our social media as well. So if you are looking for that, it's on our Functional Medicine CE website, and we'll have recordings up there. So even if you miss it on March 2nd, it'll be available. So why don't you just start by giving us a little bit of background on today? Our topic is chronic infections, but how did you get to that point? A little bit about what you were seeing in your practice.
Absolutely. And thanks for having me on this. I've always had a fascination for the unknown. And so they're from a very early age, always thinking about things in a through looking at things from a wide lens and trying to uncover things and putting my detective cap on. So I think that was just inherently something I've always enjoyed. I was on track to first pursue physiotherapy. That was a passion of mine. I've always been involved in fitness and rehabilitation. And as a kin undergrad, that's a standard issue. You look to get into physio. Mm-hmm. I had to take a hip pause after undergrad. My mom was dealing with a very unusual neurological presentation. It ended up being undiagnosed for 3 years. She was working with countless neurologists here. We finally made a trip overseas and were able to receive a diagnosis, get her stabilized on the appropriate meds, and come back. And kind of just navigating that, I started to think about moving into medicine and conventional med and started to put applications out. But through her healing journey, we were exposed to a host of what we would consider complementary and alternative med into way out into left field, into wild energetic medicine, and just very things that we were very open to and interested in, but were certainly broadening my horizons. And it was wild. She had a spontaneous remission at one point following an energetic medicine treatment. And I just stopped in my tracks and said, there's so much more to this healing process, and I need to kind of just take stock of what's happening here. And I wouldn't say luck, but it was very serendipitous that a friend said, you need to look into naturopathic med. I had no idea what it was, got into that. It was one of those situations where the doors just open, and I feel very grateful and blessed to have been able to be oriented towards it, because it's allowed me to serve this demographic well. And when looking at a situation like my mother's, where she was undiagnosed and dealing with this very unusual complex chronic illness, I think that's what planted the seed. And then in my naturopathic medical training, I did a specific focused internship in chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia, multiple chemical sensitivity, which really reinforced the understanding that this is a very underserved patient population. There's so much we can do to offer, and it's not these lightning cures, but there's so much we can do to help. And getting into practice, I just found that the universe brought all of these folks to my doorstep.
All of those people.
Yep, it was destined at that point.
So describe those people that are coming in. Fibromyalgia is almost like a diagnosis of exclusion in a lot of ways for people if they don't have other autoimmune symptoms. So what are they hearing from the conventional side? What is the person that walked in your door being told by their conventional provider about conditions like that?
It's one of the upsides is that it's moved from being the stigma around it being just a psychological pathology and a psychosomatic presentation. We're finally able to shift away from that. Patients are seeing rheumatologists. They're doing investigations that don't typically, like you said, it's a diagnosis of exclusion. So we're not looking at inflammatory markers or a key diagnostic marker on lab that will diagnose it, but at least it's being more appropriately validated in a conventional medical setting. But generally speaking, it'll start with patients being told that they're stressed or that they're fine, simply because lab markers are normal when they're working with their primary care providers. Those primary care docs that are maybe a little bit more familiar with this presentation or recognize that, no, there is in fact something going on here, will be more proactive in getting them seen, whether it's internal med or right to the rheumatologist, neurology, wherever they need to go. But at the end of the day, patients are still left with very few answers. They're often not validated. They're typically prescribed some form of an antidepressant, obviously pain meds to try and manage the pain element, but there's so much that's missed. So it's moving in the right direction from a validation perspective and a broader understanding, but it's really disheartening to see how patients are either just left stranded or inadequately managed.
Yeah, absolutely. So when we do you want to talk like all together about your approach as far as this person with complex illness, or specifically hone in on fibromyalgia and then the different ones?
I would say, well, in my practice, under the umbrella of complex chronic illness, fibro makes up one segment of that.
A chunk of it.
Right. So I would say there tends to be a lot of common threads when we're looking at complex chronic illness. So what I would say is we can maybe look at it through that framework and then maybe wiggle wherever we need to with these specific pathologies.
Sure. Yeah. So when someone comes in, describe like the symptoms that someone might have that are in this complex chronic illness bucket.
It's so broad. Generally speaking, we're going to see some degree of fatigue. I have patients that are bedbound. I have patients that are functional fatigued, right? Functionally fatigued, where they get through their day, but they're surviving. They're not thriving. Right. We're going to see some degree of cognitive impairment. So brain fog, difficulty with word recall, memory issues. With the fatigue, just to double back, it's generally not improved with sleep, right? So this is non-restorative sleep plus the fatigue. Yeah. And then we're also dealing with some degree of pain or inflammation. I should say inflammation. Typically, that'll come out as pain, aches and pains, general muscle aches or more specific joint pain. But that inflammation can really play out in any way, right? So where is that fire burning? And that's what we're going to see. So is it coming out more in someone's skin? Is it affecting their digestive system? Is it coming out more from a neurological perspective? But it's the fatigue, the cognitive challenge, and the inflammation that can be so varied. And then we will say it's vague multi-system symptom, because my intake form is about, I think it's gone from 21 pages to over 30 pages now, but it's because we can capture so much, right? And most times I try to cap the primary health complaints on the intake form to 5, but usually there's an appendix that's like a laundry list of things, because it sucks. There's so many things that people can deal with, but it centers around those core 3.
And I know a lot of functional medicine providers get some of these patients in our practices too. And your presentation that you're going to be giving next weekend is all about that roadmap to the assessment and figuring out where to focus for that patient. So talk to us about that roadmap picture.
Yeah, it's when you're dealing with a situation where there's so many moving parts, there's so much uncertainty, we often don't have definitive labs or labs that will definitively diagnose this pathology. You really do have to start to think about either lenses or some kind of framework to view this through. And so when I said there's common themes in the world of complex chronic illness, irrespective of the specific presentation two people have, we're looking at a genetic predisposition, whether it's grossly reflected in the family history or not. There's some degree of the genetic element that may predispose someone to that presentation. We're looking at the environmental trigger or triggers that then shift the system into the state they're in or exploit that genetic susceptibility. That could be physical trauma, mental, emotional trauma, infections, toxicant exposure. Sometimes it's really clear. It's one acute event. And here we are. I had mono. I was never well since. There was a car accident. Never well since. Went through this nasty divorce. Never well since. Other times it's really insidious and subtle. And you really have to do some strong detective work to put those pieces together. And then there are the modulators. What's turning the dial up or turning the dial down on the intensity of the symptoms and the disease state kind of day to day. And so we're starting to think about it in terms of what's fitting into those three kind of buckets to start. And then as far as going a little bit deeper in the process, what's really helpful is to start to think about, in the world of functional med, kind of physical, structural, biochemical, and mind-body. And if we can start to think about it in that way, we can start to extrapolate information about what's led to this point and what's driving this process of basically non-resolving inflammation. That's at the core of all of this. And when we think about physical, structural, mind, body, and biochemical, we're able to start to structure the treatment strategy. And there's a lot of moving parts in between all of that, but overarching kind of concept, that's really where we can start to make sense of this.
Yeah. And then within like the conversation discussing like chronic infections, where do chronic infections in like mycotoxins, pathogens fit in the picture when you're assessing these patients? Are there, does every patient that comes in with this complex chronic disease get that a workup for all of those? Or are there specific things that tip your hat to, okay, this is more likely a mold presentation or a Lyme or something else like that?
So basically everyone, at least from the intake process, as far as intake and questionnaires, there's going to be the same screening that will flag to that. And then the history taking process will generally cover those bases. But everyone is being asked about their early immune history. And this goes back to whether it was vaginal or C-section delivery. Were there any birth complications? Were they a sickly child, recurrent throat, ear infections, frequent use of antibiotics? So we'll start the conversation that far back just to start to get a pulse on what was going on from an early immunological tone or burden perspective. We'll certainly talk about the big players, whether someone had known mono at some point in their life, and how did that affect them if they did? Was there many individuals say that they were bedridden or you know, significantly affected for several weeks, sometimes months? Mm-hmm. That's going to peak, get the ears up as well. Have they had water damage in their home? Has there been some flooding? Do they have visible mold? Is there a musty or mildewy smell in any of the rooms? Do they feel really crummy when they're in a specific space in the home and feel better outdoors? So there are certain questions that would be used to flag whether there's a chronic infection. Sure. And obviously where we are asking about tick bites and time spent out camping or in the bush, or do their pets come home with ticks on them, that kind of thing, to see if there could be a vector-borne illness component, though that can often be very, can fly under the radar for so many people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And then along with, you mentioned the chemical sensitivities is a big part of your practice. How do you address that? Obviously there's like detoxification and liver support and things like that. But I think a lot of these patients, at least I know within my own team, when they get these patients coming in, they want to do everything in the kitchen sink. They want to do detox and they want to do their gut program. And I'm like, this person just needs to go to like trauma therapy first before we can do any of this. Like sometimes it's just like, I don't know how this person that's had several traumatic experiences in their life is going to handle a big plan. So how do you handle that with these complex patients and taking this like roadmap, like one step at a time and getting the patient to be able to respond well to each thing?
Such a good question. And you're so right, just to bring up that trauma element too. So when there's an individual that is hypersensitive to really everything, that could certainly be because physiology is bunged up, detox capacity is bunged up because of toxicant burden and chronic infections, mm-hmm. and this chronic immune activation and that cell danger response that can be propagated by that process. But so much of it can come from just completely like aberrant activity in nervous system response and that limbic system, that fight or flight system activation. So when I'm looking at someone and they say, doesn't matter what, I had a patient come in and say she can't sleep when she takes vitamin D and she gets constipated. I'm like, what? Like it's vitamin D. What's the carrier? What's going on here? And it is one of those people that looks at a supplement and it can blow them up. And so if someone is hypersensitive, the starting point is going to be that limbic system retraining. We're really not going to get anywhere. We're not going to push the needle unless we're able to start to balance out that nervous system's hyperactivation that comes from really that hyperactivated, stuck on a nervous system response and trauma response.
Yeah.
So that would be a situation where we pump the brakes and we really just focus our attention on something like that. Other than that, if that's often going to be incorporated in some degree, it's just, do we need to, you know, stop everything and focus?
Hold off everything else. Yeah.
Besides that, if mold is an issue, I found this in practice, certainly the mentors I've worked with and the advancees that we do in this space, the general consensus is that if there's a mold burden and if we're dealing with this genetic hypersensitivity, susceptibility, and this culmination of toxicants, but mold is one of them, we generally need to deal with that first. It's not always feasible, realistic for someone to get out of the moldy space to do a full remediation. So sometimes we have to think about how we're managing the exposure versus eliminating it. And here, where we are in Ontario, Canada, there's not going to be a house without mold. It's just, how are we managing things? But mold would be one of the key things that would need to be addressed before we can get into other toxicants. And then there's different schools of thought, but usually we would look at kind of mold, then parasites and fungus, bacteria, viruses. That order of operations often has to be modified based on the specific presentation of the person sitting in front of me. But I would say at the very least, if there is a limbic system hyperactivation from a trauma element, that's primary order of business. And then if there's a mold element, I find we're not getting anywhere unless we somewhat, to some degree, get a handle on that. Then we can start chipping away at those chronic infections. And whether it's mono first or the parasites or fungal burden, again, there's a general framework, but often we'll have to pivot. And sorry, heavy metals, because I forget.
Yes. That.
I find the heavy metal component can open up a can of worms if we start to hit that too early. I know there are other docs that'll just jump into chelation right away. I tend to look at that as one of the latter pieces. It can be tremendously disruptive to physiology, but I find that if we don't reduce the chronic immune activation and start to chip away at the other things first, I find at least the nature of the patients I see, and I'm the end of the road doc, so they're usually not doing well. Mm-hmm. They can't handle it very well.
Yeah, I think chelation too is such a very specific thing. And like people need to be working with experts in that area to be able to do that. And so for the general functional medicine practitioner, like working on all the other things to help your body properly detoxicate before you would do something heavy hitting like that is definitely important. Coming back to the mold piece, are you doing specific lab testing to evaluate mold? And if you find it, how do you determine your treatment plan?
And like I said, most folks that I work with will have some degree of mold exposure. So I come into it with the assumption that, okay, there's going to be something going on here. We'll try and get a gauge on whether we're seeing this kind of MCASI presentation or something that might flag that we need to be a little bit more focused on that evaluation. And I will typically look to have some kind of mycotoxin assessment done via lab testing. Historically, I've relied on urine testing. I know there's a movement now shifting more towards kind of serum testing, because I've seen time and time again with colleagues where they'll use the same urine sample, run it through two separate labs using the same technology from a urine mycotoxin analysis perspective, and we're getting different reports. And I don't like that, and I don't really know what to make of that.
For obvious reasons.
And so I know there's, even just in the past week, I saw a forum discussion around amongst colleagues around who's shifted gears towards the serum testing and what are they getting from that. And on the one hand, I like the laboratory testing to help guide and influence, or to help provide insight as far as the burden and what specific mycotoxins are we dealing with. But at the same time, often the history can tell you a lot, right? And so I would say the bread and butter is always going to be the history and what that tells you and the patient's story. But I will use the lab testing and then based on that, start to have the discussion around, okay, what evidence do we have that there is in fact a mold burden in the home? Again, was there water damage or leaking? I have patients who have kind of seasonal flooding, right? Every spring, their basement is getting water infiltrated in from through the foundation and things like that. So sometimes it's very evident that's what's going on. Mm-hmm. Other times a little bit less, but then I might move into more of a, like an air quality screening in the home to start to get a pulse on what's going on. And we have one particular individual in the area here who's the go-to guy, and I'll typically refer to him and he'll do an exceptionally detailed investigation. And then we know what's going on. And I had a patient, a young female patient, maybe 16, 17, couldn't get ahead of her case. And it was really nasty, just as far as how progressive it was. Her urine mycotoxin test, and we ran it twice, was clear. But finally we're like, this is a mold case. I can't, no matter how I slice it, looking at you, everything is like this. I got colleagues to sit in and it's like, this is a mold case. Finally, we had her do the air quality test again. Her aspergillus levels were higher than anyone had ever seen. And in her case, and then we did some other testing and found that, yes, it was in fact colonizing her gut and some other things were going on. But so it can be a little bit challenging to navigate when you're dealing with this situation where you hope for a lab test to be definitive, give you the insight, let's move on to treatment. But long story short, it's not in the world of mold. So you may have to approach it in a multifactorial manner. And then at the end of the day, you sometimes just move ahead with empirical trials, right? We shipped her out. We got her to go to what we believed to be a safe space for 2 weeks. Symptoms improved. She came back, symptoms worsened. We used binders, symptoms improved. Stop the binder, symptoms worsen. Yeah. You may have to approach it in this kind of multi-layered approach. But yeah, so we are looking for testing to guide, knowing the intensity of that mycotoxin or what that can do to the body will sometimes influence how aggressively we treat. But for some of these sensitive folk, mycotoxins, mold allergy, and either way, we got to do something.
I think that's a good point because I find there's this whole like test, don't guess piece in functional medicine where everybody is, you have to have a test. Right. And like a lot of times the person sitting in front of you telling that story is able to tell you more than this lab testing can confirm. Just, we have amazing tests. And I think So I think the same situation with SIBO and yeast, you could send your SIBO test to multiple places and depending on what substrate you use and what they use, like you might get a different result. So I know some companies even stopped doing SIBO testing for a while in the functional medicine space because they were like, we're not getting the same reproducible thing every time like you're talking about. And then, and not that I don't use SIBO testing because I think when it's positive with glucose substrate, okay, yes, like we've got it here, but like the lactulose positivity has got more false positives. But looking at the whole picture, am I going to treat this person anyways because of the digestive symptoms that they're experiencing? And if so, is it even necessary to do this breath test and pay this money? So I totally hear you. And I feel like so often, especially new practitioners to this space are often like, well, I have to have the data. But so much of what we do in functional medicine, you can hear along that story of what they're telling you and their experience and how the symptoms line up with that.
Yes. And I'll explain to patients, we're thinking, is the test accurate? Is it specific to your case? And is it going to guide treatment? Right. And if it's not going to change treatment, you know, you may still choose, we operate in a private system. You may still choose to proceed with it if it's going to help validate, provide some objective feedback versus me just telling you, but you're totally right. Yes. There's a time and a place.
Yeah. And I see that a lot with like nutrient depletions. Like I could tell someone they need to take vitamin D and a multivitamin, but until they see it on the paper that their levels are low, like that helps to validate, yes, I need to take this. And, you know, seeing the numbers helps them to move forward with a treatment plan. Or people with diabetes, I take care of a lot of metabolic people, like an A1C number or watching their CGM rise like drastically after their carbs, then they're like, oh yeah, I do need to do something. But otherwise they feel no different. So they're just like, and I think too, like functional medicine interventions often take a long time to really see the results because they're so used to instant gratification. This antibiotic got rid of my sinusitis so quickly, and it doesn't happen that quickly. So keeping along with the process, sometimes the lab testing is really helpful for that purpose, but making sure we understand that it's not the end all be all of our treatment plans for patients, I think is really important.
That's right. And just to maybe circle back to something you said before, when we were talking about chelation and just that being a more advanced intervention and that kind of thing, but just to pull back, thinking about that in terms of testing as well, there's so much foundational work to do. And I find we often put the cart before the horse because we can, right? We've got these tests, we're searching for answers. We know from our perspective as practitioners, we have a broader understanding of what we can do. But yeah, there's so much just foundational things to do to even get into a position where the data we get from those labs can then guide treatment in such a way that we get optimal outcomes, right? But there's just, if we can just take a step back, appreciate just getting those pieces in place, ducks in a row. And you said it, it's a process, this world of functional med and the work that we can do from a root cause or root-based medicine. So yeah, there's, it's easy to just get caught up in other things.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Talk to us about those foundational pieces for you. What is it for you that like has to be like working well for a patient before you can even move into any kind of detox or mold reduction or Lyme antimicrobials?
Absolutely. And you brought some of these points up earlier, but thinking about it in terms of, again, physical, biochemical, mind, body, starting with the physical or structural element. In Ontario and in Canada, we have osteopaths that are manual providers versus DOs that operate in a slightly different setting in the US. But the vast majority of my patients will automatically get a referral to see a manual therapist of some kind that works not just on stick it where it hurts kind of medicine, really looking at what can we do globally to support fascial tone, recognizing that nociception, pain signaling in the fascia is multiple fold greater than what we would experience elsewhere in the body. And no wonder everything hurts because your fascia is stuck from all of these scars and this physical trauma and dehydration and not enough fruits and veggies and flavonoids in your diet. And so looking at a manual therapist that can help support just mobility and flow within kind of the fascial body. A manual therapist also has the ability to support that autonomic nervous system regulation, whether it's craniosacral or something gentle that can start to get the vagus nerve balanced out a bit. Basically, thinking about the body starting out normal and coiling up over time, and we want to provide messages to the body to gradually uncoil it.
Yes.
The body remembers the original blueprint, and we can work with manual providers to help facilitate that work. Somewhat hands-off in the sense that, you know, you're seeing a provider to help support that, but there will be but there'll be some homework.
Yeah, passing. I love that because I actually have an OMT appointment this afternoon after this call. I have been a big fan of osteopathic manipulation. I worked in a clinic with DO providers, and it was actually a residency training program. So they were teaching the other the residents how to do proper osteopath, and they would always need practice subjects. So I was a practice subject for several years. But it's so important, even in babies that are coming out of the uterus and they're all coiled up because they've been in there so tight. When we have these colicky babies, they do so well with tea and just being able to help relax their body and get their spine back in alignment and the muscle structures. So yeah, it can help with feeding and even from the early days of life. So yeah, from a, I always am referring to whether it's some kind of physical manipulation, whether it's OMT or chiropractic in the US, getting people's bodies in balance, because you definitely see it's crazy. Even certain points in the spine, if that is out, you have heartburn. And I know exactly, like all of a sudden I have heartburn. I never have heartburn. I go in like, this, I can't even remember the thoracic one it is, but you're out there. And I'm like, oh, it's so crazy how the body, like that piece, like influences your nervous system enough to affect your digestion. And but all throughout your body, like that's happening in different places. Totally. And certainly our postures and everything that we have sitting frontwards like this. And so anyways, I interrupted foundations, but I am just echoing the physical manipulation.
Yeah, let's put an asterisk beside it. And the way I think about it is we can try to fix the flickering light in the kitchen, but if the electrical supply to the house is not working, what are we really doing? Right. So let's work with someone that's going to get that neurology and communication pathways in the body supported. So I think we're certainly on the same page when it comes to that. So there's a physical structural element from the mind-body perspective. I'll typically do some form of assessment in office, usually a heart rate variability assessment, and start to give them some feedback of, as far as you know, where their body is in terms of that fluidity between kind of fight or flight and rest and digest state, using a basic practice, whether it's breathing, visualization, gratitude, to see how we can shift that rigidity in the nervous system's regulation, and then sending them home with some degree of homework, whether it's as simple as just splashing cold water in their face to get that vagus nerve awake, if that's where they're at right now, or whether we can move into some form of a more formal and consistent practice. We're certainly going to be looking at some degree of kind of stress system regulation, vagal tone balancing work. And then from the biochemical perspective, there's so many different ways we can approach it. So it's going to be individualized to some degree, but I try to get everyone oriented towards at least the basic foundations of an anti-inflammatory type diet. And for some folks, it's a bit much to ask them to cut things out. So we'll talk about what can we do to just get some berries in. Let's get some of the brassica, the broccoli family veggies in. Let's get some more omega-3s in. Something along the lines of some basic anti-inflammatory diet work. For some folks, we have to go right into like autoimmune paleo or something else that because of the nature of their presentation, but thinking about something along that vein that we can start with. And another thing that I try to emphasize in the biochemical space, and I'm not a dental health professional, but trying to get their oral health in check, because for so many folks, that's going to be a major barrier to healing. We're not talking about yanking out metal amalgams and getting root canals investigated to see if there's cavitation. We're not going there yet, but just basic stuff. Because if we're not, we always forget that digestion and the digestive tract starts up here in the mouth, right? And if we're working on the gut with kind of a weed seed feed approach, but we're not working on the mouth and the oral pathology, and the oral health, we stop short of what we can do. So I'm going a little bit off center here, but those are some of the things that might come up that we start to think about.
Yeah. And how do you, for people that I know you said you have some people that are bed bound, but how does movement like factor into this and like getting lymphatics and things like that to be foundationally a little bit in a better place?
It's at the very least. So if someone were to do a head and neck lymphatic drainage, this is a pretty long write-up that they get when they leave the office. Yeah. If they're to do a head and neck drainage practice, which could be done with kind of the homeopathic drainage creams, good old castor oil, or just use your hands. And we'll get them to do some pumping at the termini of the lymphatic channels just underneath the collarbones on both sides. Start to get them doing some work at the head and neck to just get the lymph flowing. And this would be the person that we're not able to necessarily do too much more. But I forget the research, but you can increase systemic lymph flow by 30% just by doing head and neck work, right? That's such an important piece just because, again, that's where it all drains into. Yeah. For most folk that are able to, we'll start on that. And if they find that challenging, then I'll get them just to use castor oil or one of the homeopathic drainage creams just to start to get things moving. But we'll start with that. Otherwise, there's the Perrin technique, P-E-R-R-I-N technique. And if people can dedicate 5 minutes to the short technique, that's the next step, because now we're going to really get everything moving lymphatic-wise. And then if they are in a position where they can physically move, we're getting them moving. Is it Tai Chi, Qigong? Is it yoga? Or is it more of a formal standard or conventional form of exercise or walking just to get things moving? But my background is in fitness and rehab, and so I tend to emphasize that as much as I can and pass the baton and see what they can do with that.
That's awesome. Yeah. And then from a bowel standpoint, are you doing, if they're coming in, they're not pooping for a week? Or I see a lot of these people that are so sick and they're just like, yeah, I got a bowel movement once a week. And I'm like, what? Like, how is that possible? So what are you doing there from a foundational standpoint at the beginning?
That's really important. And I appreciate you bringing that up. So on the one hand, we want to try and facilitate daily bowel movements. In some circumstances, I'll send them off. We don't have the scope to, but I'll connect them with practitioners that can do a KUB, kidney, ureter, bladder x-ray to see if there's fecal loading in the ascending colon.
Yeah.
And if there is, sometimes this is one of those hit pause, nothing else. We got to deal with this. And we'll do like a magnesium flush protocol where we're basically inducing watery stool 1 or 2 days a week for an extended period of time. And between those flushes on the weekends, where we're basically inducing loose stool with magnesium oxide would be the tool here. And we're doing nothing else. And the reason for that is, one, we're all going to be cognizant of the fact that if someone's backed up, what are we really going to be able to do to get the digestive tract in check first? You would never use a clogged toilet. Let's get things flowing. But if there's a significant amount of fecal loading and fecal matter just caked onto the intestines, especially that ascending colon, which has to go up against gravity, there's going to be so much biofilm there. There's going to be so much Clostridia and other dysbiotic bacteria that are going to be throwing off their neuroendocrine activity, that we're going to be spinning our wheels. The antimicrobial herbs or pharmaceuticals, if that's what someone's using, it's not going to touch it. You're going to hit them with anti or biofilm disrupting agents. It's not going to do it because it's caked. And I was, one of my patients said they started to see the aliens coming out in their stool, in their bowel movements. And so now I call it the aliens. But when people start to see the aliens coming out, the fibroid, the mucoid plaques and fibrotic biofilm, we know we're starting to get there. For some people, it could be 1 month, like 4 weeks before we start to see it. There are patients where it's 6 months to 12 months before the aliens are coming out. And depending on the severity of the constipation, the chronicity of the constipation, it might be one of those stop, all hands on deck, let's get this dealt with. But at the very least, getting them having regular bowel movements with the support of magnesium oxide and then obviously diet and lifestyle strategies. Otherwise, we may need to just, that's it. This is what we got to do. And in some of the neurodivergent cases, it's wild to see how much can shift simply by getting that biofilm out of that ascending colon. It can be life-changing for these families.
Specifically on the biofilms, are you adding any biofilm disruptors other than just the magnesium?
Not when we're doing that. Magnesium oxide in the right, in the right dosing, as long as someone's compliant, because it sucks. It's not a fun protocol. It's a big ask, but when they get into it and when they start to feel the difference, it's a big win. So often I won't lead with that. They have to have some kind of trust in the process. Yeah, build some rapport with them, get some small wins before we get into that. But generally not. You don't need to generally worry about antimicrobials or biofilm disruptors in that setting. If we're having to do somewhat of a hybrid approach, I have some folk that are like, I can do this maybe once a month or something. Then I'm like, okay, we got to fill in the gaps. But if they're fully committed, the nice thing is it's just that. And we're managing their hydration status and electrolytes and otherwise very low burden with other supplements and pills. Like, it's really a very impactful monotherapy.
impactful.
No pun intended.
No pun
Yeah,
intended.
really.
As far as like the dosing on that, are you using like a magnesium oxide powder or capsules?
Powder. And then,
Got it.
yeah, you can go anywhere from 500 to 1500 milligrams once or twice a day
Okay.
in the lead up. We start low, go slow a bit just to not really mess with
Yeah.
people. The worst side effect we might see would be some cramping, some abdominal discomfort cramping,
Yeah.
and we pull back. It's interesting though, the amount of patients I've had on super high doses that don't have any response. It's just like either you're dehydrated because we're not getting that osmotic effect, or
Yeah.
we have so much to do just to get to the starting line. But yeah, magnesium powder, really nothing else, and going from there.
Sure. As far as, so circling back to like recap what we've talked about, what do you feel like for the majority of patients that are coming to your practice, what are like the big things that you find the most impactful, or I don't know if you want to walk us through like a case example of like someone and then what you did along the way, whatever you feel. I know you're going to present some cases next weekend, so whatever you want to close with.
I would say these standards, and again, I tend to operate more in the world of the
Yeah.
biochemical pillar of
Right.
those three. The main things that we're looking at, one would be if there's constipation. I'm so glad you brought that up, dealing with that first because nothing's going to move otherwise. I didn't really talk about this within the comment on the foundational support, but the liver detox element is
Yeah.
going to be big because, again,
Yeah.
there's going to be, if there's a backlog or a bottleneck, someone's going to feel horrible when we start to do things and mobilize
Yeah.
toxicants. So we're typically incorporating some degree of a detox support intervention. Some people, we may need to think about genetics in terms of figuring out where in that process they're backed up, or is this someone where if we're supporting phase one of detox with B vitamins or dark leafy greens or that kind of thing, they feel really bad because their phase two is really slow. So generally just trying to do everything through that process with B vitamin support, that intermediary stage, i.e. supporting anti-inflammatory, antioxidant capacity. We're supporting that phase two of detox with glutathione amino acids. So
Yeah.
constipation support, some degree of detox support with some core nutraceuticals, B vitamins, antioxidants, amino acids, including glutathione. Glutathione can push mold a bit hard for some people, so that may not be the thing we lead with. The other thing that I'll typically bring in, and this is after that first visit, between the first and second visit, while we're completing the more thorough assessment, this is some of what we have. The other thing that tends to be a big one would be redox support, right? Thinking about that glutathione system capacity and oxidant, prooxidant, antioxidant balance. So we're typically thinking about things like vitamin C, vitamin E, to just get the antioxidant recycling pathways supported.
Yeah.
We're then coming in with something like N-acetylcysteine to help with that glutathione production. And then thinking about, again, core glutathione, whether that's liposomal or IV or however else we might go about intervening with that. But that would be another kind of key element. And then that's all balanced out with some degree of symptomatic support. Are they coming in with a histamine
Yeah.
dominant, histamine intolerant MCAS presentation, in which case we're trying to weather that storm, whether it's your
Sure.
mast cell stabilizers or the B vitamins to help with histamine metabolism, DAO. Recently, the amount of POTS and dysautonomia that I'm seeing is horrendous, and it's in these young, predominantly female patients, and it's completely debilitating, and there's reason to believe there's a post-viral element to it and other factors. If that's the case, then we're doing a fairly focused, conventional, but blended intervention there. So yeah, then putting out fires and symptomatic support, but I could go in a million directions as well.
Sure. Yes, I know this complex thing. Yeah. Are you seeing specific viruses? Like, is COVID the trigger for a lot of the POTS patients, or are there other viruses that are you're noticing are also?
Certainly I've seen a ton of it post COVID natural infection and post-vaccine in susceptible individuals. It can take quite a long time to resolve. But the way, and a colleague said this, he looks at COVID as the great revealer, right? And I was listening to Heather Zwicky, the immunologist, recently, and she said, what's fascinating is where autoimmunity would normally take anywhere from 5 to 18 years, I forget what she quoted exactly from the study, to manifest from that acute onset
Sure.
virus or pathogen. We're seeing it post-COVID in 3 to 15 months. Right. And so what would normally be a
Yeah.
slow burn is just fast and furious. So most of these folks would have some underlying factors, right? And we know that COVID is a great reactivator of the herpes family viruses, whether it's EBV, CMV, yeah, or HHV, or whatever it might mm-hmm. be. So there's usually something else that's smoldering, and then COVID comes along and throws the mm-hmm. fuel on it, right? But COVID's a big yeah. one, whether it's the inflammatory burden in and of itself or some kind of other viral reactivation. Yeah. But in the world of pandemic, post-pandemic setting, I would say that's one of the biggest drivers I'm seeing in this massive uptick of dysautonomia, largely in the yeah. form of POTS.
Yeah.
Which is yeah. brutal.
And it's interesting because I feel like in the last 5 years or so, like, you didn't really hear about dysautonomia. You didn't talk about POTS. And it was very, like, one person I knew had it from that I went to pharmacy school with. And then all of a sudden it's mainstream. People are talking about this. This is occurring all the time. Mm-hmm. So for those patients, what are, like, the biggest wins that you're seeing for them as far as addressing the dysautonomia piece?
Yeah, I realize I left a massive gap in discussing this. So this kind of ties into that.
Yeah.
I would say in my practice, again, being an end of the road doc, I tend to see folks that really, even with, and this is not a knock to anyone, it's just the somewhat standard approaches, even within the world of naturopathic med, don't serve some sure. of these patients simply because of the underlying factors. The biggest missed piece for the vast majority of patients that come to me, and this is upwards of 80%+, would be some degree of connective tissue disorder within the specifically joint hypermobility. Not necessarily yeah. like full-on EDS, Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, but
right.
some iteration or yeah. some variation of that presentation. What I yeah. find is that the most stubborn cases tend to fall under that umbrella. I would say the vast majority of the POTS cases I see recently seem to be, again, that's the predisposition, and this virus is just completely...
Yeah.
decimated that kind of system.
Yeah.
So what I find is, yeah, we end up using high dose, high amounts of salt. We end up doing lots of hydration. We end up doing compression. What's it called? Clothing.
Support. Yes. Stockings.
And the usual things, try to get them on a recumbent bike and get things moving. Usual things. And then naturopathically, things like licorice and ginkgo and bilberry, and I put together a specific mm-hmm. tincture for them. But the other thing is, if we don't adequately support the underlying connective tissue abnormalities, we can really fall short in supporting them. And so that comes in the context of brick and mortar, things like vitamin C, glucosamine, manganese, copper, to help support the yeah. actual, give them the building materials. But you can have the best building material in the world. If you don't have workers, what are we doing? So mitochondrial support, CoQ10, carnitine. Yeah. So we're thinking about that nutraceutically. There's a modality called frequency-specific microcurrent, which can be really helpful in supporting the vagus nerve trauma that happens because of the ligament laxity in these individuals. So their okay. nervous system's out of whack. They can do HRV training all day, but every time they move and are faced with gravity, the vagus nerve gets traumatized, and that's going to be a problem yeah. for obvious yeah. reasons. How are we healing? And in situations like this, and I'm going a bit far down the rabbit hole, but I think this is pretty important.
That's okay.
If there's craniocervical instability, CCI, the upper cervical, the ligaments that connect the skull and the neck, if those are lax, that's a major proprioceptive center. That means that yeah. that communicates to your brain where we are in space, much like the jaw and the talus, where our mm-hmm. ankle and leg meet. If there are ankle injuries, jaw issues, and or this upper cranial instability, what that's going to do is, instead of us having this conversation like this, it's as if I'm speaking to you through a megaphone cranked up to 10, that's crackly. The brain goes yeah. on fire. And there's a very potent autonomic neurological dysregulation that comes from a physical structural abnormality. So
sure.
we do the nutraceutical support. We have to work extra hard to get the gut in check, because they're going to have leaky gut because their connective tissue is yeah. wonky. So we do all of the things, but that one is where we really have to double down on the connective tissue and structural yeah. support. So for those POTS folk, especially if they're not responding to conventional or functional approaches, that's often where we need to shine the lens. So ask them, are they hypermobile? Were they that kid that could pull their thumb all the way back?
Yeah.
Or do they have poor wound healing, atrophic scars,
sure.
that kind of thing. Sorry,
yeah.
I digress.
No, but, that's yeah. great information. But yeah, it's so important. It's so important because there's so much of this going on right now, right. and so many people that don't have answers.
Right.
And yeah, so I think that's a great place to end, and you know, be able to have people listen to this and share with their friends and family, because I think everyone knows someone right now that's dealing with some aspect of dysautonomia. So hopefully this message, I was just going to say that you should come up with a supplement like line for dysautonomia based on your experience in this connective tissue piece. You could really
where I've had something there. Focus the attention based on that.
Yeah.
And what I would say is, maybe to close on this, the silver lining through the pandemic is that finally post-viral sequelae, post-viral fatigue, post-viral POTS, immune dysregulation is finally going to start getting the research and attention it deserves.
Yeah,
and for 30 plus years, we've known that these things are happening, but people have not got the validation they needed. They've certainly not got the treatment mm-hmm. they've needed. There's been no integration amongst specialists and other allied healthcare professionals. So finally, there's a glimmer that we're moving in the right direction. It's been a rough time and people are really suffering, but there will be, there should be some light at the end of the tunnel here.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, thank you so much for joining the podcast. Yeah. Thank you so much for joining the podcast, and we're looking forward to your CE presentation next week.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
And for those, and again, for those of you who are listening, if you're looking for the CE presentation, it is going to be at functionalmedicineCE.com, and you can also find our team at farmtotableteam.life. And where can they find you?
LiamLatouche.com is my website. It needs an upgrade, but that's where you'll be able to jump up. Otherwise, Instagram at Dr. Liam Latouche, or on Facebook, same kind of handle, but you can certainly stay in touch. And I welcome questions, comments. I love to stay engaged with people, and education is big, and we need this information to get out there. Happy to connect.
Awesome. Yeah, thank you.
Thanks so much.